Welcome to Eco Radio KC. On today's show, we'll be discussing environmental education. But first, these headlines. According to a November 12 press release, NASCAR has announced that during its nationwide series race in Phoenix, Arizona, it surpassed more than 5 million competition miles across its three national series using Sunoco Green E15, a biofuel blended with 15% American ethanol made from American-grown corn. The 5 million miles have been accumulated across practice, qualifying, and racing laps dating back to 2011 when the biofuel was introduced. In 2011, NASCAR entered into a partnership with Sunoco and the American ethanol industry, launching its long-term biofuels program to reduce emissions of the fuel used across its three national series. The transition to the biofuel reduced on-track carbon emissions, and teams report an increase in horsepower. Cigarette waste is the most littered item across the globe, according to Nina Prewal, the general manager of TerraCycle Canada. Now, when cities and businesses grow weary of dealing with the heaps of cigarette butts and other waste left behind by smoking enthusiasts, they have a place to turn for help, and Vancouver, British Columbia is leading the way. As part of its efforts to become the world's greenest city by the year 2020, Vancouver is teaming up with TerraCycle, a New Jersey company, and two Canadian social service agencies, United We Can and Embers, to turn cigarette waste into a variety of industrial products, such as shipping pallets and plasticized lumber, rather than sending them to landfills. As part of its pilot program, 110 receptacles to collect butts will be mounted on posts around Vancouver's downtown. The butts will be collected by employees from the city's downtown east side, who will take them to United We Can, which already runs a recycling depot for bottle collectors, and will send the butts onto TerraCycle Canada for recycling. Cigarette butts are made from cellulose acetate, a plastic product made to look like fiber. Although it does break down slowly in the environment, it never loses its toxicity, therefore poisoning essential links in the aquatic food chain. TerraCycle will melt the cigarette butts down and pelletize them, removing not only any residual odors, but also any toxins or carcinogens, so the end plastic is completely safe. TerraCycle hopes to expand the program to cities around the world, but in the interim, the company has teamed up with Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company to form the Cigarette Waste Brigade, inviting people to collect cigarette waste on their own and mail it to TerraCycle. At TerraCycle's website, TerraCycle.com, individuals and organizations can sign up to join the brigade. Currently, there are 3,850 collection locations, with 1,150 slots still available. Cigarette waste, including extinguished cigarettes, butts, loose tobacco pouches, outer plastic packaging, and inner foil packaging, rolling paper, and ash, can be collected into a plastic bag or disposable plastic container. Once enough is collected to ship, a prepaid shipping label can be downloaded at TerraCycle's website. You just print it out, affix it to your cardboard shipping box, and drop it off at a UPS location. Cycling enthusiasts and commuters now have a new way to stay safe, the invisible bike helmet. In response to the introduction in 2005 of a Swedish law requiring mandatory helmet use for children under the age of 15, which triggered a debate regarding whether helmets should be mandatory for adults also, industrial designers Anna Haupt and Therese Alston were inspired to use their master's thesis as an opportunity to discover whether it would be possible to develop a cycling helmet that people would be happy to wear, whether they had to or not. The result of their explorations and 7 years of research is the Hovding helmet, an award-winning design consisting of an airbag hidden in a fashionable neck wrap that deploys around a cyclist's head in a tenth of a second during a crash. Alston told Public Radio International, quote, "You put the collar around your neck and there's a zip at the front of the collar. You zip it up and then there's an on-off button that you need to activate the system with. So you push the on-off button and you hear a sound signal that says doodle-a-doo, and then you know that it's on," unquote. There's a little LED display on the collar's front that shows the device's battery level. The battery is recharged via its USB port. The airbag itself is designed like a hood and made of an ultra-strong nylon fabric which won't rip when scraped against the ground. As with most new technologies, the helmet doesn't come cheaply. The Hovding retails for €399, or about $540. Ms. Alston, however, says that the helmet is a worthy investment considering how seriously cyclists can be injured in even minor crashes. And if a cyclist does crash while wearing the Hovding helmet, he or she can send back to the company the little black box contained inside the collar, which records 10 seconds of data on the cyclist's movement patterns during the accident. Hovding will use that data in their continuing efforts to increase the helmet's effectiveness and cyclist safety. Low-impact transportation options just get better and better. For more information on any of our stories, find EcoRadio KC on Facebook and Twitter, where we'll post links to some of our sources. While you're visiting, we invite you to like and follow us. We are also now streaming live, and downloadable podcasts of EcoRadio are available at kkfi.org. And now, on with the show.
Thank you, Susan. This is Mike Murphy here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and this is Eco Radio. We've got a pretty interesting show today. We're going to hear Richard Mabian's interview with UMKC Professor Michael Frisch, and well, he's an interesting guy, and I think we'll be hearing more from him. First, a couple of programming notes. Democracy Now! Heard on KKFI every weekday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. All week we'll be broadcasting from the Climate Summit in Warsaw, Poland. So they started today, but you can tune in tomorrow at 8 o'clock and hear for yourself. Here's some other things coming up on your community radio station, and then we'll get into the interview with Richard and Michael.
Hi, I'm Sam Daly Harris, author of Reclaiming Our Democracy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how you and I can make a difference on the issues we care about.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
In recent months, the Supreme Court has struck down key portions of the Voting Rights Act. On the next All Souls Forum, we're going to hear Professor Edward Cantu, Associate Professor of Law at UMKC, discuss the ramifications of this vote and the history of the Voting Rights Act. That's Wednesday night, 6 p.m., right here on KKFI, the All Souls Forum.
This is federal worker Cynthia Lee of the Department of Treasury Financial Management Service, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI, CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
Hello. Again, this is Richard Mabian, and I'm sitting here with a professor from UMKC who I'm very interested in, know very little about, so we're going to start this off right from the top. Mike, introduce yourself.
I'm Michael Frisch. I am Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Design, Program Director in Urban Planning and Design in the Department of Architecture, Urban Planning and Design at UMKC.
Okay. I saw that behind your name with your emails that you sent me, and I went, I don't see a thing on here about the environment. So if, in fact, this is an environmental show, why am I talking to mics? You tell me.
My background is in environmental planning.
Okay.
For a good 8 years, I worked with Dr. Barry Commoner.
Who is that now?
He was a famous environmentalist. He just passed away last year. He was on the cover of Time magazine during the first Earth Day. He wrote a book called The Closing Circle that had the four laws of ecology. And so he was a central figure in the grassroots environmental movements of the 1960s and 70s, all the way through, you know, the recent decade, always supporting grassroots environmental groups.
Wow, and you studied with him?
I worked for him.
Worked for him, yeah, but that's studying.
Yeah, it is.
Worked for him, that's pretty good. All right, so that's back in the day. Now, bring me up to now.
How do I end up in urban planning from the point of view doing environmental work? Well, when I worked with Dr. Barry Commoner, I found out, and you were working, we were working with lots of local communities dealing with some very big issues, you know, fighting incinerators or fighting problems in their community, often not to their choice. You know, it's suddenly they discover that there's an environmental problem. I found out that the key people in government to get on your side were the urban planners, because they understood the dynamics of local land use and the impact that has on the community. And if you could convince the planners that your analysis at least had standing, we could usually make some progress. And so urban planning as a field has a fundamental belief in community engagement, that people work together to plan for the future of their community. Oh, so if you can hook that in from the point of view, if you're working in your community for environmental improvement and progress, you should probably get involved in urban planning processes, because how land is used usually impacts the environmental conditions.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and I'm just salivating. I just want you to know that this is just this is just right down my alley, because I work in communities, and with a lot of entities within a community, from your political structures to your construction structures. And the biggest problem I have is doing exactly what you're talking about, is making them understand the value of including the environment in their planning. They don't. They build a house to make a buck. They build a house because there was some money available for building houses, and they got that money with a great plan, because they're great planners. And they, for a great plan, oh my God, for a great plan. Y'all excuse me, I had my phone on, but we gonna move right on. Excuse me.
Well, I can comment while you're doing that. I think our economic system in the United States is based on kind of making a buck, and our environmental, you know, if you're planning for the environmental future, your time scale is longer than it is if you're planning by market conditions alone. So this idea, you know, market conditions, if I'm doing financial planning, I'm always thinking about the time value of money, and I'm discounting the future. And if you're an environmentalist, you're not discounting the future. You're investing in the future. I know there are people out there who think that there's no conflict between economics and the environment, but if you're in a capitalist society,
right,
that's working on market conditions, there are going to be some conflicts there. Now, we can still work with market conditions and the environment, but we have to also understand that if you're working for the environment, You're generally taking a long-term view.
You know, yeah, I mean, I'm with you 100%, because I came in, got started teaching people what the environmental literacy. That's what I do. Yeah. And I started spending time, created the conference, brought in outside people to talk and teach people here in Kansas City metropolitan, because people don't know. We might have environmental organizations, but people don't know what the heck the environmental movement or circumstances is about. So that's what I learned needed to be done. People need to know. So I brought them in. We started teaching them. Still, those environmental organizations did not understand why they should be working in conjunction with people. They still kept working by based on whatever funding source they were able to give them some funds. I, and on the other hand, saw that in the work that I had done, I had reached a point where the economic aspect needed to be included. You can't go any further without having the economic aspect in it, but you need an economic-minded person
to come to the plate, and there's very few that are talking in the manner that you're talking right now. That's what's sitting there flipping me out, because I knew that person was needed.
In Kansas City, and a lot of this is just the our environmental problems are partly created because we have land use, land markets, and rich people can always move away from the environmental problem. And so the areas that are probably the most contaminated or that have the highest pollution levels are often areas of land that are nearest to factories or mm-hmm. to industrial sites that have been there for many, many years. And so these are old industrial areas, and then often those places were planned before we had our modern land use zoning system that separated out land uses.
Mm-hmm.
So our older industrial areas tend to be in the valleys. They tend to be by the railroad tracks. And so you think back 100 years, well, workers, and they were people were taking the streetcar to work, and if you could live near the factory, that was less money, and you wanted to save as much money as possible. Factories didn't necessarily pay a living wage back then. Open question whether or not I
can. They do it now, yeah.
There was a moment in the mid-20th century where we really did have, you know, after the sit-ins
right.
and the auto factories, there, you know, auto factories paid a living wage. And
right.
I still think
they still
probably
do.
Auto factories
right.
still do.
Right.
But many others don't. So the if I were, you know, if I had to pick areas that were going to have the highest probability of having environmental problems in Kansas City, I would look to these older industrial sites, older neighborhoods that were industrial 100 years ago.
Like Fairfax.
Pre-zoning.
Like
yeah.
Fairfax.
In Fairfax,
Kansas.
The Kaw River Valley,
yeah.
the both the East and the West industrial districts, so the West Bottoms, East Bottoms, they had factories 100 years ago.
Right.
So if you live next to them, or if you're living in those areas, and there are folks living in those areas, there's a higher probability of exposure. And not necessarily to materials being used today, but to materials that were used 100 years ago.
Right.
So lead, cadmium, mercury, all of these materials have been in our industrial ecology for over 100 years. There are newer materials post-World War II, you know, petrochemical industry, mm-hmm. plastics industry gets going, and there are new materials and toxics that come from that sort of production. But that production, at least in greater Kansas City, ended up in areas that were designated as industrial.
You know, two things, though, I'm going to mention on hit on here. One, from time to time, as the people's advocate, I like to consider myself the urban Michael Moore with the mouth that roars from time to time. I have to speak up to try to bring some attention to what I see as being the failure of the kinds of programs that's being used in our community. You heard me at the Equity meeting
yeah.
come out, and I know half the people there haven't spoke to me since then, but I let them know that I thought that they were putting entirely too many nonprofit programs in the inner city. Not that you shouldn't have them, but it's exclusively nonprofit programs.
No,
it's too difficult. And when your money runs out, the programs run out. We're not creating sustainability.
No, okay? And there's a concept of fair share that doesn't. Every community have a responsibility to provide some low-income units, but where are those Section 8 apartments in Mission Hills?
Right.
That's
yeah,
the question.
Yeah, yeah. And
they don't exist.
Well, and that is the level of communication that I hear coming, even from some of my black leaders will say, well, I don't think you should. When they start testing people who live in Johnson County for to see if they've been abusing drugs, then I could understand them testing welfare recipients before they get their checks. You'll get them kind of comments coming out because as a nation of people, that's how we've been taught to think. But I'm saying we have to come back to the basics again, and what you're talking about is here, and we need to be able to combine these two worlds. we need to think in terms of sustainability, economic sustainability. You know, build something, but build something. Like right now, I think in terms of all the hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands, trillion dollars since the 60s has been spent in rehabilitating and rehabbing our inner cities. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a factory. I mean, I would love to see a warehouse built that would hire people to run forklifts or something that would put people on a job. I heard that Chicago has spent $75 million in overtime pay for police officers because of all the murders that's going on up there. $75 million could create some jobs, a business, something that makes something, make a bicycle, I don't care what it is, something that people use. We don't have that type of mentality in our urban planning department.
So, you know, I gave a positive view of urban planning before, but now you're bringing up the underside. Mm. That planning, since the 1920s in Greater Kansas City, has facilitated the separation of communities from each other.
Yes.
So Mission Hills is able to keep out Section 8 units. Where are the jobs? The jobs are all outside.
Yep.
They're around the 435 corridor, you know. Beltway
right.
in Greater Kansas City, and folks in the inner city that don't have cars cannot get to them.
Get there.
And that's an enormous problem.
Right. So
and
they concentrate on rapid transit to appease the pressure of people complaining by saying, we're putting together a great rapid transit system that's going to be able to get people from in the inner city out to where the jobs are. So they're in the process. That's all you hear. That's all you've been hearing since my guy, they ran out of town, was talking about some rapid transit. What was his name? They ran him out of town?
Oh, I'm not a big supporter. That was Clay Chastain. I'm not a big supporter.
That's all right, but I mean,
but
it's been going on since his time.
This issue of getting folks who need jobs to where the jobs are is really important. And in our mass transit planning, until we begin to bring the jobs back in, the streetcar purpose, you know, it isn't really serving a lot of people's needs in neighborhoods.
Right.
But what it may do is it may spur development and spur the growth of new jobs and back in the core, in areas where folks from all, at least in urban neighborhoods, will be able to get to those jobs.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a better community.
Right.
Transit-wise, though, this issue of getting folks who need jobs to where the jobs are is probably an issue of figuring out van pools, figuring out...
Okay.
And maybe folks just have to take the matter into their own hands.
That's the only way it's going to happen, because I go back to this, and we got about a good 5 minutes left here, so I want to kind of summarizing what we're doing. But I want to add this behind what you're talking about. In the 70s, I got hired by the state of Missouri to be a group therapist and with court-committed juveniles. And my purpose was to move those juveniles to create a inner city treatment facility. At that time in the 70s, all your hardcore youth from Kansas City and St. Louis were being sent to Boonville. And when you got to Boonville, what was happening, you had a rural staff. You had kids with city problems that's being placed in a facility with rural staff. That went together like white and black. I mean, it was constant just explosion. So mm-hmm. Here's what the problem is with this mass transit getting our inner city people out to where the jobs are. The people running them jobs out there are more urban or more suburbanites than they are inner city people. They don't have that kind of interpersonal relationship that I, as a community organizer, knows is needed for the caliber of persons who are coming out of them neighborhoods for a job. So at this juncture, I mean, give me a 50-year plan and we'll get them out there. But at this particular juncture, I need my city leaders to be trying to figure out ways to create jobs within the neighborhood, within the community, within the distance existence that they live, so that the people who they end up working for are the people who actually live and operate in the same kind of community. Because our deal is, and I've been hearing this, and then I'll let you come in, but I'm loving talking to you. I could do this for a whole hour. That the biggest problem that we have in society now is our soft skills. People are saying that we can't find people who are being taught to be modern day Americans in the shape we need. We got attitude problems. We got all kind of problems. Mm-hmm. Now, I know I ran off at the mouth there for a second, but I want to hear you in a summary by this summary way of what this conversation has meant to you.
I think it's very important to kind of create jobs in the inner city. I think you're exactly right that, you know, there is a responsibility to create those jobs where the folks are now. However, yeah, I will say that there are those jobs in the suburbs, and the other responsibility is to work with those folks to get them comfortable hiring.
Yeah, well,
each
that,
other.
You gotta so have both.
That's the type
both.
Of change that's right. going to take a long time.
It's going to take a lot. I told you 50 years. We got to have both, but I still think that an effort to deal. In fact, I want you to come back. We're running out of time.
I will come back. This is a fun conversation.
Oh, yeah. I'm loving this.
I like how it's touching on many important issues.
Right.
And I actually think that we have a lot more to go.
Yes. All right, Mike, I really appreciate you coming in, and I've enjoyed sitting there talking to you. And like I said, we will do this again. You're going to become one of my regulars, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And that was Richard Mabian with Professor Michael Frisch from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I do have another programming note for you. Interesting program on Thursday's Making Contact. While countries like Japan, Italy, and Germany begin to phase out their use of nuclear energy, the U.S. aims to build the first new nuclear power plant in nearly 30 years. Thursday on Making Contact, we hear excerpts from the film The Atomic States of America, which chronicles the rise of nuclear energy, the high price some communities have paid for it, and how the U.S. is pushing to redefine nuclear as green to meet our energy demand. And it features Kelly McMasters, who's the author of Shirley, A Memoir of an Atomic Town. That's the Shoreham nuclear power plant on Long Island. And Arne Gundersen, who's a very highly thought of consultant on nuclear energy. You may have heard him speak with Helen Caldicott back when we aired her program, If You Love This Planet. And also Dave Lockbaum, nuclear engineer and senior member of the Union of Concerned Scientists. So that's the Atomic States of America on Making Contact this Thursday at 12:30 p.m. And again, I want to remind folks that all week on Democracy Now!, they're offering coverage right from the climate summit in Warsaw, Poland, right there on the ground. Of course, they're more often than not on the outside talking to the activists. But fascinating program. So tomorrow at 8 a.m. and every day the rest of the week. And speaking along those lines, here's Amy Goodman.
Typhoon Haiyan demands climate action at the UN summit in Warsaw. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Typhoon Haiyan, a storm of historic proportions, has devastated the largely impoverished population of the Philippines. Thousands of people are dead. Hundreds of thousands are stranded with almost no food or water, and millions have been impacted. The struggle to survive competes with the race to bury the dead, treat the wounded, and suffer through the onslaught of tropical storms in Haiyan's wake. In seeming synchrony, halfway around the world, thousands of negotiators, scientists, politicians, and journalists are gathering for the annual United Nations Climate Change Summit, held this year in Warsaw, Poland. The changing seas that this week have whipped the Philippines demand a sea change in the worldwide response to global warming. As COP19 opens in Warsaw, the 19th meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the Kyoto Protocol, one courageous climate negotiator took center stage, demanding action on climate change.
What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here in Warsaw.
So said Nadarev Yebsanyo, representing the typhoon-ravaged Philippines as the summit opened. This was not his first appeal to the UN body. Last year, when the summit was in Doha, Qatar, and not long after Typhoon Bopha killed 1,100 people in the Philippines, Sanyo implored the gathered negotiators, holding back tears.
The outcome of our work is not about what our political masters want. It is about what is demanded of us by 7 billion people. I appeal to all, please, no more delays, no more excuses. Please let Doha be remembered as the place where we found the political will to turn things around.
Doha did not turn things around. Report after report reinforces the science. Catastrophic climate change is accelerating. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the association of more than 1,800 scientists that is leading the global study of climate change and which shared the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore in 2007, recently released its fifth assessment report. With increasing certainty, the IPCC reports the climate is changing and humans are the cause. Jeff Masters is a meteorologist and founder of the popular website Weather Underground. Unlike most U.S.-based television weather forecasters who rarely link extreme weather events to climate change, Masters regularly makes the connection. He said on Democracy Now! NewsHour,
the proportion of these sorts of high-end Category 5 storms has increased. So if we look at the total number of storms worldwide, it seems that when we do get them, there's a higher proportion of them coming in at these super high intensities.
Masters and the IPCC point out that no individual weather event can be directly attributed to climate change, but that the frequency and intensity of the storms will increase. While the science is dry and peer-reviewed, the reality on the ground is grim and deadly. Typhoon Haiyan, which is called Yolanda in the Philippines, is the latest epic example. Superstorm Sandy, 1 year ago, hit New Jersey and New York City, shutting down one of the largest cities on the planet. It's too soon to call the UN climate summit in Warsaw a failure. Earnest negotiators have gathered in Poland alongside activists both inside the national stadium where the conference is being held and outside in the streets. Activists from Greenpeace called attention to Poland's intense dependence on coal-fueled power plants by projecting messages onto the huge smokestack stating, "Climate change starts here." At the same time, 28 other Greenpeace activists faced 7 years in prison in Russia for protesting the first exploratory oil drilling rig in the Arctic. The two journalists covering them faced the same charges. Many consider Warsaw just a stepping stone to the climate summit planned for Paris in 2015, conceding that immediate action is not possible. Why? At the climate summit in 2011 in Durban, South Africa, a representative of the youth delegation addressed the closing plenary, expressing frustration with the slow progress. Anjali Appadurai said,
"I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists? Corporate influence? Money? You've been negotiating all my life. In that time, you've failed to meet pledges. You've missed targets and you've broken promises. The International Energy Agency tells us we have 5 years until the window to avoid irreversible climate change closes. The science tells us that we have 5 years maximum. You're saying, give us 10. The most stark betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion. There is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach.
Chief Filipino negotiator Yeb Sanyo is not giving up, either on his family, many of whom were directly hit by Typhoon Haiyan, or on the process. As he closed his statement at the opening session in Warsaw this week, he announced,
Mr. President, and I express this with all sincerity, in solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, and with my brother who has not had food for the last 3 days, with all due respect, Mr. President, and I mean no disrespect for your kind hospitality, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight. This process under the UNFCCC has been called many, many names. It has been called a farce. It has been called an annual carbon-intensive gathering of useless frequent flyers. It has been called many names, and this hurts. But we can prove them wrong. Mr. President, Your Excellency, Honorable Minister, my delegation calls on you most respectfully to lead us and let Poland and Warsaw be remembered forever as the place where we truly cared to stop this madness. If this is our imperative here in Warsaw, you can rely on my delegation. Now, can humanity rise to this occasion? Mr. President, I still believe we can.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Thanks, Amy. And don't forget, Democracy Now! All this week reporting from the climate summit in Warsaw, Poland. This just in, courtesy of Eco Radio KC veteran Steve Mann, the Cornucopia Institute is reporting that there's a final 30-day public comment period on USDA consideration of opening the United States to the growing and sale of genetically modified apples. This comment period goes from November 8th through December 9th, so it's already underway. We've posted this on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page, and so you might want to check it out there. And thanks again to Steve Mann for making that available to us. And the next piece we're going to go into is rather interesting. From July to early October, Shodo Spring, a 64-year-old Zen Buddhist priest who's the mother of two and grandmother of four, led a walk from the tar sands oil extraction region of Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska, some 1,300 miles along the proposed route of the Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline project. We'll air a piece on that courtesy of Between the Lines, a radio program you can hear every Friday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! And this is put together by the Squeaky Wheel Project.
From July to early October, Shodo Spring, a 64-year-old Zen Buddhist priest who is a mother of two and grandmother of four, led a walk from the tar sands oil extraction region of Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska, 1,300 miles along the proposed route of the Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline project. After being arrested in Washington, D.C. in August 2011, during a protest against the pipeline that would transport dirty tar sands oil to Texas refineries for export abroad, Spring decided to walk the route to meet people on all sides of the controversy and to bring peace to the area. She says the central impulse for the Compassionate Earth Walk, as it's called, was a response to climate change, which she believes is the most likely cause of the current droughts, floods, and extreme weather events the world has witnessed in recent years. Spring asserts that the situation will get much worse unless people collectively take drastic action. She made the entire journey, walking about half the miles, while a core of 6 to 8 others walked in either Canada or the United States. Other participants joined the walk for shorter periods along the way. Growing opposition to the extraction of tar sands oil has been provoked by scientific research that finds the energy source produces far more greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming than conventional production methods.
President Obama is expected to make a decision on whether or not to approve the Keystone XL pipeline project sometime in 2014. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Shoto shortly after she finished the walk and returned to her home in Minnesota. Here she shares some reflections from her journey and summed up what she considers the walk's impact.
There was a rancher in Alberta who we met through a church, and we had dinner at his house, and a very lovely conversation about the whole thing, you know, the climate change and what can you do and what can't you do and everything. But he took us out to his ranch where he was keeping part of it as native prairie. But he actually drove a considerable distance to come and talk with us. I wanted the walkers to hear from him because I had met him last year. And it's coming across his land. And he refused to sign. And they took him to court, and he lost. So what happens is TransCanada comes in, and they have a contract for an easement. And most people say, oh, look, money, and they sign it. So you're getting some money, and you're doing a good thing because you're helping there be energy for people, and it's needed. Some people have gotten together in groups and bargained for better easements is what they usually do. And then a very few people just refused to sign. And he said he wasn't against the pipeline in the first place, but they lied to him so much that they turned him against the pipeline. People keep saying lying and double dealing and refusing to answer questions and high pressure tactics. He was referring to the Cowboy and Indian Alliance. He said it had put him in contact with so many different kinds of people that he never would have been involved with. You know, he would have stayed with the people who were like him. And instead, he's become totally easy with people of all different kinds.
And the Cowboy and Indian Alliance, that's white ranchers and indigenous folks who are all against the pipeline. Is that right?
Right. I mean, what a great, great title, right? And of course, the great thing which we observed, they've observed, everybody has noticed is, oh, look, the same people who came and took, or that their ancestors came and took the land away from the Indians, now need help from the Indians to protect their land, which used to be the Indians' land, because treaty rights are major, major help.
Would you say that in general, people in Canada and in the U.S. have a different attitude about the pipeline?
Not exactly. In Canada, you know, we met a few people who were against the pipeline, but mostly not. Most people were for it. Oh, but there were some farmers and ranchers who are kind of grumbly about it because they can't get farm help anymore. Because you can make $28 an hour right out of high school if you go to work for the oil industry, oil and gas. And a farmer can't afford to pay $28 an hour. So this one guy that we camped at his place, he said he could have gone with, I don't know if he meant sold his land or whatever, but he wouldn't do it. But it's really hard to do agriculture anymore, because the labor force is going where the money is. It seemed like, till we got about halfway through South Dakota, most people were pro-pipeline. They weren't thinking about oil spills, and they weren't thinking about climate change. We heard more of the religious thing there. God's in charge. And then, like, southern South Dakota and all of Nebraska, the people we saw were like, it was all about pipelines and spills and the aquifer, and they're ruining our lands and they're violating our rights and everything.
Shoto Spring, what did you set out to accomplish, and do you feel like you accomplished it?
The single clear intention that we all had was to walk every foot of that way. And we took turns, so the what walking every foot meant was the staff went every foot. And except for 3 miles where there was road construction and they shuttled the walkers and there was no option, we did that. So that we accomplished. Other things were, you know, we did have a lot of positive encounters with people. We don't know what the effect of those encounters was. Certainly the people who are anti-pipeline frequently felt encouraged and inspired by our being there. The group that was on the walk, I think, learned a lot. There were people who just kind of stumbled into it, and they learned a lot about politics and activism and Native issues and all the stuff that came up there. But the people who came more intentionally, they matured in being able to work in a group. people were speaking in front of groups, not often, but everybody, they made beautiful statements. And so I think in terms of building activists, we had a positive effect.
That was Buddhist priest Shoto Spring. Find links to more information about Shoto's Compassionate Earth Walk and tar sands oil extraction by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
And folks, we're going to open up the phone lines just to discuss if you have any issues. Please restrict your comments to those environmental issues. 816-931-5534. Give us a call and let us know. Perhaps there's an environmental issue you think Eco Radio KC should be covering and hasn't yet, or you haven't heard it. While we do that, while you call 816-931-5534, let's hear from David Rovics doing Pipeline.
As soon as they started drilling for oil, they started building pipelines on the seabed through the forests and across the border lines. As soon as they started laying the pipe, they said, we'll do this safely. There will never be an accident. We can do this carefully. But the sands shift, the ice melts, disasters are routine. Point out their record of destruction, and they'll say their hands are clean. Point out their woeful deeds, and they'll consult their banker and say it's safer to use a pipeline than an oil tanker. So now they want to see how far their madness it can go. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. The tar sands line the north beneath Alberta's ground. As the price of oil rises, the oil men have found. Now there's profit to be made in a madman's dream by drilling deep beneath earth, blasting it with steam, bulldozing the land, melting what's inside, a record of extinction 1,000 miles wide. But laying waste to the northern plains is evidently not enough. The capitalists need markets where they can sell this toxic stuff. So across the farms and prairies, the oil now must flow. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Governors oppose it. Every native band, ranchers don't want it passing through their land. Union leaders have denounced it, as have the rank and file. The president delayed it for just a little while. They say you can't stop progress. I hope that isn't true, cause if we mine the tar sands, if we let the pipeline through, it will be a pipeline to oblivion, a pipeline to the end, a pipeline to a future with nothing round the bend. A pipeline to a future that I hope we'll never know. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico.
Ah, yes, David Rovics. Very good and very immediate, always in the present tense. David Rovics, his songs have what John McCutcheon would call a short shelf life, but immediate and in the moment and right on point, David Rovics. And we do have the phone lines open, 816-931-5534. If you want to call in and weigh in on an environmental issue, we'd love to hear from you. I do want another programming note. We air a lot of environmental programs here on KKFI. Tomorrow evening at this time, 6:30 to 7 to be specific, Ann Peterman will speak on climate justice. You know, the monster storm that struck the Philippines has killed thousands and left hundreds of thousands homeless. This happened right before the international climate change talks were getting underway. But are the media making the connection between climate change and this catastrophe? Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project talks all about that on Counterspin tomorrow evening at 6:30, right after Mic Check. And we're going to hear a couple of messages, and maybe we'll hear some more music, or maybe we'll hear your phone call, 816-931-5534.
This week, we meet the man who emails a prayer to President Obama every morning, Joshua Dubois.
I got his email address from a friend of mine and drafted up a brief reflection, and I sent it off to him and held my breath wondering if I was going to get fired, and he wrote me back and said, Joshua, this is exactly what I needed this morning. Would you do this every day?
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before the Jazz Disciples.
Hey, it's the Christmas Claus here announcing the KKFI Ho 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 Holiday Online Auction this December with all kinds of goodies donated for people just like you. Help us grow the biggest auction ever by donating that forgotten treasure in your attic, a special baked gooey pie or cake, or an afternoon of babysitting, room painting, or house cleaning. Be generous, be creative. To donate, contact Bill at KKFI or email billc at kkfi.org.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Our adaptation isn't built on our ability to build a new machine. It's built on our ability to live places where people have not lived before, under conditions they have not lived before.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us this week when our guests will be John Mohawk and Gary Nabhan. It's Surviving Climate Change on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Missed last week's Echo Radio KC? No worries. You can listen online at kkfi.org.
Well, I spoke to my neighbor last Saturday. He was changing the oil in his car. He told me that he does it every 3,000 miles, and four times a year he goes that far, and I got to thinking that he uses 4 quarts every time. And he does it 4 times every year. In 10 years, that's 40 gallons of oil, and I thought I'd better make myself clear, so I walked up and then I said, "Excuse me, sir, that's my aquifer. What are you pouring on the ground?" "Fred," I said, "please tell me what you do with that oil that's all dirty and brown." He said, "Sure, I just take it over behind the garage, and I dump it, and that oil just sinks into the ground. And I know I maybe shouldn't, and if it were a lot, I wouldn't, but it's really only just a little bit." I said, "Fred, I'm about to tell you something. I hope you'll listen to it." He said, "Excuse me, sir. That's my aquifer. What are you pouring on the ground?" Well, see, Fred didn't know about the aquifer, so I told him. See, Fred, underneath the ground, there's an aquifer. It's an underground sponge, if you please. Every time you get some water for a bath or drink or shower, you give the sponge a little squeeze. And anything around that's been soaking in the ground moves closer and closer to your well. And then before you know it, it might not even show it, but it comes out of your faucet, and then you yell, everybody sing along, "Excuse me, sir.
Excuse me, sir.
That's my aquifer.
That's my aquifer.
What are you pouring on the ground?" Back in 1989, there was an oil tanker named the Valdez, and it soiled Alaska's beautiful shore. But the United States loses one Valdez worth of oil on the ground every month or more. It spills out of cars and trucks and buses, and that oil keeps sinking down into the ground for all of this very long time. And I can't help but think that every time I take a drink, I'm sipping on a little bit of slime. "Excuse me, sir.
Excuse me, sir.
That's my aquifer.
That's my aquifer.
What are you pouring on the ground? What are you pouring on the ground?" And maybe we should all be careful out there. Not only community radio, it's a community resource. It's an aquifer.
That's right. That was none other than Stan Slaughter. Stan was on, was that last week, talking about biomimicry, and he'll be joining us again with his Green Spirit Band on December 23rd as part of a holiday concert on Eco Radio KC, along with the band Solar, a couple of local environmental groups performing on Eco Radio KC that night. We're just about out of time, and I want to let folks know that our calendar is coming up, and then after that it's Dialogo Abierto, followed by Sabor Latino. And if you want to listen, please by all means stay tuned. But if you haven't got your green on yet, our sister station, community radio station KDHX in St. Louis, starts their environmental show, Earthworms, coming up at 7 o'clock. That's KDHX.org. So thanks for listening, everybody. And this, too, will be up on our podcast soon.
And now for our calendar of events for the things coming up in the week ahead and the near future. Tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., the Sustainability Action Network will hold a meeting at St. John's Family House, 1301 Vermont Street in Lawrence. There's a broad swath of discussion topics, and the meeting is open to the public. For more information, visit sustainabilityaction.net. At 9:30 a.m. Friday, join Bioneers here on KKFI. The discussion will center around surviving climate change and how secure a far-flung global economy and our food supply is in time of climate change. Also on Friday, the Bad Seed Farmers Market, which is at 1909 McGee in the Crossroads District of KCMO, will feature its annual Thanksgiving Market from 4 to 9 p.m. There will be a plethora of farmers whose tables will be overflowing with fresh, local veggies and meats, nuts, bee products, handmade goods, and more for your holiday table. For more information, visit badseedkc.com or visit Bad Seed's page on Facebook. Eat local for the holidays. Saturday will be the final Brookside Farmers Market for this 2013 season. The Brookside Farmers Market is an organic local vendors-only market, which means all producers use organic, sustainable, and cruelty-free practices that travels less than 100 miles to market, and those who grow, raise, or make every product are the ones who sell it to you directly. Visit the market from 9 a.m. to noon at the corner of 63rd Street and Warnell in KCMO. For more information, visit brooksidefarmersmarket.com. Next Monday at 5 a.m., join Explorations here on KKFI when guest Lori Bongiorno, author of Green, Greener, Greenest, will discuss how to become an environmentalist. On Saturday, December 7th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Kansas City Wildlands is again offering the public an opportunity to remove invasive red cedar trees and take them home to decorate for the holidays. The event will again be at Shawnee Mission Park, 7900 Renner Road in Shawnee, Kansas. Please bring a handsaw, no chainsaws or axes, please, and rope to tie your tree to your vehicle. Sturdy boots and work gloves are recommended. Pre-cuts will be available, and volunteers will be there to help you cut, carry, and tie down your tree if needed. A fire and hot cider will be available to warm your toes. Kansas City Wildlands is also seeking volunteers for the event. For information, contact Linda Lehrbaum at 816-561-1061, extension 116, or via email at linda@bridgingthegap.org. From November 17th through January 26th, Southeast Enterprises, a local nonprofit sheltered workshop, will partner with over 165 locations throughout the Kansas City area to provide drop-off sites where the public can bring their non-working holiday lights for recycling. Once collected, most of Southeast's employees will work to prepare the lights for recycling. Last year, the combined efforts of Southeast, sponsors, and citizens throughout the greater Kansas City metro helped to save over 32,000 pounds of holiday lights from the landfill and keep Southeast employees working throughout the calendar year. Collection containers will be placed at participating locations throughout the greater Kansas City metro for drop-off. For a full list of collection sites, visit kcrecyclelights.com. The Kansas City Food Circle's annual meeting will be held Saturday, December 8th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Waldo Library in KCMO. That's at 201 East 75th Street. The topic du jour will be GMOs. What's the big deal? With the meeting featuring a panel of local growers and food activists to discuss the issues of growing, processing, and procuring local non-genetically modified feedstock for our local egg, meat, and dairy producers. The meeting is open to both KC Food Circle members and the public. If you cannot attend the meeting, the Kansas City Food Circle would still like to hear your thoughts. Email coordinators@kcfoodcircle.org or call Dave Lawrence at 913-620-8427. If you'd like to correspond by traditional mail, please send all comments to KCFC, P.O. Box 20181, Kansas City, Missouri 64195. And more information can be found at kcfoodcircle.org. Thanks for joining us today on Eco Radio KC. Join us next Monday at 6 p.m. sharp. And remember, you can always stream the show live or download a podcast at kkfi.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.